If she wants to go in with Kelvin, that Jensen is teaching that class, so give him some company if you like. He'd probably appreciate it. Yeah, not having to be the only student in the class. Okay, we know Paul's defending his apostleship, and as he is, and I'm going to kind of summarize the first part of this chapter. The thrust of his argument is this. God gave him the assignment to go preach the gospel to the Gentiles, which included Corinth. And since he was fulfilling his assignment, and he affirms that, then they should appreciate him for what he is and what he did, because he was just complying with the Lord's will. And rather than question and attack him as one who allegedly is not genuine, that he is not concerned about them, as some have alleged, that he's not an apostle, again, as others have alleged. They knew better than that. I mean, after all, he spent a year and a half there. As he says a little bit later, he performed the signs of an apostle. He was able to work miracles. They saw it. They believed it. They accepted it. And so, therefore, this whole business of even giving ear to his detractors is ludicrous. But yet he is compelled to defend himself. And as he says in the latter part of this chapter, he's not doing it just so he can feel some sort of self-satisfaction from that. He's defending himself because of the more serious ramifications of denying him, and that is, if you deny him, then you're denying his message. And if you're denying his message, you're denying the Lord. And so it's because of their soul salvation and his concern for them that he defends himself. And so he argues that point, and then he also argues the fact that God gave him the measuring standard, or measuring stick, or yardstick would be a good analogy. And also, in carrying out his commission, he didn't go beyond what he was commissioned to do. He did what the Lord required of him, and so he didn't overstep his bounds. And again, he has no ulterior motives. He has no hidden agenda. So all of these things are abundantly clear if they would just reflect upon what they knew about him. Now, his accusers are in effect saying, well, take a look at us. And Paul says, you know, the problem is they're comparing themselves with themselves. They're not comparing themselves to the Lord's standard. And they're not arguing from the standpoint of whatever God commissioned them to do, because God didn't send them on this mission. They took it upon themselves to be defenders of the Judaistic system, and these are primarily Judaizing teachers. But the biggest problem he has with them is their motives, their arrogance, their haughtiness, and their determination to set themselves up as the standard, as the benchmark. So he said in verse 13, "But we will not glory beyond our measure." And again, the measure there, I believe, includes two things, and we talked about this last week, that it includes not only the measuring instrument, which is the revealed word, but it also includes the assignment that he was given. And he said, so everything that I'm doing is in harmony with that. I'm not going to go, you know, beyond what God wants me to do. But according to the measure of the province which God apportioned to us as a measure, to reach even unto you. So Paul said, what God assigned me to do and what I was doing in connection with that included coming to you in Corinth. So, What was one of the charges that they had made against Paul in terms of his motive for what he was doing, and especially what he was doing in Corinth? Remember? Can you give me one? What?
He wasn't taking any money.
All right. He wasn't out for their money? I mean, that I think that's the main point he's alluding to here. He wasn't out for their money. In fact, he refused to take support. He worked at his own profession of tent making just so that his enemies couldn't point their finger at him and say, "See there, he just wants your money." So he said, "No, what we did is we came to you because we cared for you and because, again, we were fulfilling, or in the language of this text, according to the measure of the province which God apportioned to us as a measure to reach even unto you." So he was authorized to come there, and in connection with that authorization, he did. "For we stretch not ourselves over much." In other words, we're not going beyond what God assigned us to do. "As though we reached not unto you, for we came even as far as unto you in the gospel of Christ." That's what he came for, was to preach the gospel. He came because he cared about them. Not any of these other allegations that have been made are true, or even remotely true. And besides all that, in terms of the chronology, he was there a long time before the Judaizing teachers were. And so they were Johnny-come-latelys. And so if the charges they were making against him were true, and that is, they were the guys to look at, and they were the ones that really cared, then why is it that they weren't there before him, if they were so concerned about the Corinthians? See, their whole argument is built on a house of cards. I mean, it's all a big bunch of baloney. It's smoke. That's all they were doing, was blowing smoke. So he said, "We came there unto you as in the gospel of Christ, not glorying beyond our measure, but as in other men's labors, but having hope that as your faith groweth, we shall be magnified in you according to our province unto further abundance, so as to preach the gospel even unto the parts beyond you, not to glory in another's province in regard of the things ready to your hand." This gives us a little bit of an insight into the MO of his detractors. They were taking credit for the work that was done in Corinth. How dumb is that? Paul says, that's not the way we operate. Remember, he had said earlier that we don't use carnal means. We don't follow the means and method of the world. Yet what they were doing was trying to make it look like they should get all the credit for the good that was done in Corinth, when in fact they weren't even there, you know, before Paul was. Can you imagine a politician trying to take credit or place the blame on other people and make himself shine in the eyes of the electorate? I mean, I can't believe anything like that would ever happen. That's the way politicians operate. I'm not saying all politicians are that way, but that seems to go with the territory. These guys were politicians. That's what they were. They were a bunch of religious politicians. And so, not all the politicians in the world are in civil government, are they? You ever worked in a large corporation? Are there any politicians there? around every corner, just about, right? I mean, a friend of mine tried to get me to go to work for Fannie Mae one time when I was in the appraiser, and I said, are you kidding me? He started telling me the horror stories about the politics that go on, and of course that was a quasi-government organization. I said, I wouldn't last 15 minutes because I'm not about to put up with that nonsense. I have never been a good politician in any way, shape, fashion, or form. And I don't want to be. It just burns me up. So it's best for me to stay out of that stuff. That's what Paul's dealing with here, is a bunch of religious politicians. And remember, we talked about the fact that they pull no punches. They're going to do anything they can in any underhanded way. They have no conscience. They have no restraints of conscience whatsoever. So whatever works for them, they're going to do it. And they did. And Paul said, "That again, we didn't do that. We didn't operate that way. Not glorying beyond our measure." Glorying, the word glorying literally is boasting. And that's the way it's rendered here in this English Standard Version. We do not boast beyond the limit. Beyond limit. God placed limitations upon the work that Paul did, and the measuring instrument, in the labors of others. But our hope is that your faith increases and our area of influence among you may be greatly enlarged. Again, Paul points to the fact that his concern for them all has to do with spiritual matters. Their spiritual growth. In this particular concern of his, what is the main thing that he is worried about insofar as their situation is concerned at this particular point? What's he worried about? What does he want them to grow beyond, Richard? Yeah, under the influence of the Judaizing teachers. And so he said, what I'm hopeful for, what I really am striving for, is that your faith is going to grow and mature so you can overcome and defeat the influence of these guys that are trying to lead you in the wrong direction. So as to, verse 16, so as to preach the gospel even in the parts beyond you. Do we have any indication of where Paul would like to go after things get settled down in Corinth?
I'd go to Rome.
Rome and where else? Further west.
Spain.
That's right. He had some long-range plans. But the immediate concern was, hey, we got to take care of business in Corinth. We got to get this mess straightened out. Got to get these people on the right track. Because they're in peril. And so until that's done, then he sent Titus down there and these words of admonition, and he's going to come and follow it up later with a visit, personal visit. And then he said, hopefully then we can go on to parts beyond. And we know from what he said in Romans that he wanted to go to Rome and to Spain. And by the way, when we get there, it's not so we can brag about what great things we have done, but somebody else has already been there ahead of us and done it. Here's a little dramatic irony or sarcasm. Like, hello, the guys that are over there bothering you right now, they're bragging about what I've done, and we're not going to do that. We're not going to go off over to Spain or Rome and say, oh, boy, look what we've done when somebody else has already been there and done it ahead of us. I like I guess because I relate to sarcasm so much. I like the way Paul gets his little, you know, digs in. But in all seriousness, he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. That's the basis for boasting. And it's not boasting in the sense of, look at me and look what I've done. No, it's boasting because look at what the gospel has done. Look how it has impacted these people's lives. Look what changes they've made. Have they made some big changes? Some of them were what? Idolaters, fornicators, homosexuals, adulterers, effeminate, pedophiles. No, read 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Drunkards, thieves. Sound like some folks in this part of the country, huh? And everywhere else in the world. Sound like a bunch of sinners. That is what Paul is glorying in. The power of the gospel to change these people's lives. And isn't that the gist of what he says in the next verse? For not he that commendeth himself is approved, but whom the Lord commendeth. That's what it's all about. It's the divine stamp of approval upon the soul of people who have turned to the gospel. And that's bottom line. That's all that matters. Because if a person is living in such a way that God approves of that life and that lifestyle, then what other commendation matters? Doesn't matter how rich you are or how powerful you are, or, you know, what kind of, you know, car you're driving or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. Nothing matters that's eternal in nature. And Paul said, that's what I'm doing. All that I'm doing is in view of that. Which is dramatically different from what his Judaizing opponents were doing. They were trying to build a following that would make it would feed their egos. Paul has no ego to feed. Any preacher or teacher that has an ego to feed is an agent of the devil. Oh yeah, they might be preaching the gospel all right, but their soul is lost, I guarantee you. And I think I've known some of those guys, and you probably have too. Your thoughts or comments through the end of the chapter? Yes, Richard.
Yes, were those Judaizers, were they converted Jews? What exactly was their position?
Well, there were very different brands of them, but essentially, they would say, okay, if you want to go along with this gospel stuff, then, you know, we're not going to make a big deal about it, except that you better be sure that you continue to keep the law, and among other things, some of them were saying, unless you're circumcised, you cannot be saved. You know, that issue was dealt with in depth in 1 Corinthians and Acts chapter 15. Of course, Paul alludes to that a time or two. And then, again, because the different brands and different hang-ups that some of them had, they, you know, it would be observance of the Sabbath or some of the Jewish feast days. You know, you get that in Galatians. You get it in Romans. So circumcision was probably the foremost measure of compliance with their teaching, but then also the feast days, the Sabbath days, and some of those things followed close behind.
Did they consider themselves Christians then? they wanted to keep the old laws, parts of the old law?
Well, ostensibly, some of them would say yes. Then there's some that weren't. And, you know, that, like I say, they were. Some were, but, you know, probably for the most part they weren't, but, you know, baptized, yeah, they got wet. I mean, maybe some of them got wet. They weren't converted to Christ, though.
Yeah.
Paul?
Some of them denying the resurrection. Paul deals with that.
Yeah.
That's
Sadducean. Yeah. That's Sadducean. So, I mean, there's so many different facets of it. You really can't pinpoint and say it's any one thing.
Because it looks to me like some of these evangelists are in it for the money.
Oh, really? Oh, you're kidding me. You're pulling my leg. Well, see, that's what they were accusing Paul of. He was in it for the money. He was a dismal failure if that's what he was in it for. He was broke as a convict. Best he could do is go out and make a tent tomorrow and get enough to, you know, get by that day. And he didn't have any money. In fact, in Philippians chapter 3, he says he gave all that up and counted as garbage. Or as the King James Version, I believe, says dung, which is a little more descriptive, isn't it? In other words, it's nothing compared to the gospel. Good question, though. Any other observations or comments through the end of chapter 10, which is really not the end of the argument? Really, the rest of the book, well, at least about the 18th verse of chapter 8, 18th verse of chapter 12, not the rest of the book, but at least through the 18th verse of chapter 12, details further evidence of his proposition about what he did, why he did it, and what he was doing. So he's going to get down to even more nitty-gritty. And he's going to describe his enemies in the most vivid language, lest that anybody have any doubt about whose team they're on. These guys are not just guys that he's got a little personality problem. Conflict with. It's not a matter of a conflict of personality between Paul and his detractors. In chapter 11, he's going to nail them exactly whose side they're on. And again, he starts out with what appears to be maybe just a touch of dramatic irony. Change chapters. Get over here. Now, it's quite obvious that he's not just blabbing a bunch of foolishness. But those who would take issue with his defense of himself might say this is foolishness. And so he uses their terminology to say, well, please put up with a little bit of this foolishness, would you? Which is not foolishness. But just bear with me for a little bit. For. Here's why he asked their indulgence. For. I am jealous over you with a godly jealousy. Now, jealousy means zeal. And so this is a very strong term which conveys the idea of the passion that he has for them. It's not just that he's wanting to make himself look good, and the winner. He didn't want to be characterized as just saying, well, okay, now I won the argument. No, that's not his point. Not trying to just win the argument. What he's concerned about, again, is their soul, a godly jealousy, concern for them. As God would be concerned for them, so is Paul. And here is how he characterizes that concern for them, his concern for them. For, remember these fours, we've got to look at them to see how they tie in with the argument. So first of all, the first four in verse 2 is supportive of his, quote, foolishness, unquote. Now, this four explains what godly jealousy, what his godly jealousy is. For I espoused you to one husband that I might present you as a pure virgin to Christ. One, two, three, four, three, three. At least three or four of us in here might be able to relate to having a daughter that got married. How many fathers who really are concerned about their daughters also have some concern for their mate, the guy that they're going to marry? What percentage would you say of real fathers have some concern for their daughters and who they marry? Half? Huh? Oh, okay, good. Well, I was waiting for somebody to come up with that. I'd say about 99.999999%, wouldn't you? You know, anybody that cares about his daughter cares about who she marries, of course. Now, we've got to back up just a little bit and put ourselves in the shoes of the custom of these people, because typically, whenever the girl's future husband was chosen under the Jewish system, the father's the one that did that. He worked out a deal. He went to Levi over there or whatever and said, "Hey, let's make a deal. You've got a son, I've got a daughter." Of course, my daughter's only about 4 years old, but hey, one of these days when she gets to be about 14, she'll be ready to get married, which is about the average age of the Jew. Now. Eventually, whenever the time came for them to sort of seal the deal, she would be betrothed to him. Now, that it is way more than an engagement. It's like, well, in fact, if she were to violate her betrothal, how did the Jewish law treat her? As a what? An adulteress. An adulteress. That's right. Remember Mary and Joseph? She was betrothed to him, and yet he was not minded to put her away. The put away there is the word apaluo, which means to divorce. He could have divorced her if she had been unfaithful to him under the Jewish law, but he didn't want to do that. Well, we know that she hadn't been unfaithful. But the idea is that once betrothed to that future husband, you want to make sure that she is a pure virgin. And that's the language that he uses right here. So that when that marriage is consummated, there's no question about her purity. Now look at the figure. Paul describes himself as this father with the kind of concern that a father has for his daughter who is betrothed to this man that she is going to marry, and his concern and his supervision and his actions all are so that whenever she does marry him, she is that pure virgin. Now, Paul says, that's the way that I'm acting towards you folks in Corinth, is so that when you are married to Christ, and I think since they had already obeyed the gospel, then he must be looking forward to the Lord's return and the resurrection and the ultimate deliverance of the kingdom into the realm of the Father. That if you're going to try to paint a scenario, that seems to be the logical sequence of events. Whether it is or not is beside the point. Because his point is, that's how much I'm concerned about you, and that's what I'm doing, is to make sure that your purity is not defiled. Of course, it would be defiled, as Richard pointed out a moment ago, if they were to turn away and listen to the false teaching. They would be impure. They would be spiritual adulterers or adulteresses. And Paul is working to the end that that won't happen. So, this is a powerful picture of his genuineness, which has been under attack. And so he continues and says, "But I fear lest by any means, as the serpent beguiled Eve in his craftiness, your mind should be corrupted from the simplicity or wholeheartedness and the purity that's toward Christ." So just like the serpent deceived Eve, he knew that they were vulnerable. And so he's doing everything he can to thwart the efforts of Satan and to disarm the enemy and protect them in their vulnerability. "For if he that cometh preacheth another Jesus, whom we did not preach, or if you receive a different spirit," that is, a different attitude, which would be the spirit of Satan, I mean, the opposite of the disposition of one who is following the Lord is one who is following Satan. "And so if you receive a different spirit, which you did not receive, or a different gospel, which you did not accept, you do well to bear with him." That is, submit to us. Submit to our teachings. Submit to the gospel that we preached unto you. "For I reckon that I am not a whit behind the very chiefest apostles." Again, think about, they're saying, "Oh, Paul's not an apostle. He's got ulterior motives. He's a mercenary. You can't listen to what he says. You can't even, you know, he blows smoke when he writes, but when he comes, he's a wimp." And all of these charges have been made against Paul. And he said, "I am not one step behind the chiefest of the apostles." And he's not waving his own flag and tooting his own horn here. He is defending his apostleship. He's defending the gospel that he preached. And boy, he's not pulling any punches. And it's not just so he can win the argument. It's so he can win their souls and keep them from the enemy. Pause right there for a minute through verse 5. Any questions or thoughts that you might have, Nancy?
Mm-hmm. Because sometimes, you know, we're aware of them, and the stronger we get, then the sooner we become aware of them. But then he just becomes a little more deceitful and a little more sly, and that's just a constant
Yeah, you know what's kind of amusing to me, and I'm not laughing, I'm not smirking or laughing at what you're saying, but it's just how ironic almost it is that Paul said in the first part of this letter, we're not ignorant of Satan's methods, and he's using exactly the same tactics now as he used 2,000 years ago, and one of which is, well, charges made against preachers. Is that we just did it for the money. Just did it for the money. And, you know, if you weren't making that big fat salary, you wouldn't be here. You know, I know a couple of preachers, one in particular, that got so soured because of those kind of charges that he refused to take any money. And he worked as a handyman, painter, whatever, out of the back of his car. He had all of his paintbrushes and his tools and everything right in the back seat of his car. And just room enough for him to sit in the front seat. And I guess he spent the last 30 years of his life doing that. Now, what's tragic about that? And there's nothing wrong with being a painter. What's tragic about it is, if you stop and think about it, here was a man who was sound as he could be. He was dedicated to serving the Lord, but look how much of his valuable time was robbed because of some unthinking and just downright ornery brethren who embittered him so that he just devoted a fraction of his time to doing the greatest work of all. There's going to be a lot of people that have a lot to answer for. We all are, as far as that's concerned. But I tell you, there's a lot of self-righteous so-called Christians among some of our brethren that are going to have to answer for stuff like that. They treated him like dirt. And look what it did. I mean, and this is just one case. That's happened in too many places through the years. It's not universal. But what it does is it reminds us that Satan is still in the business of doing anything he can do to detract from and deter and destroy the work of the Lord. And he's happy as a clam if he can get a man who could devote all of his time to preaching the gospel to only devoting, 5% of his time. I mean, he can grin from ear to ear because that's just that many, that much less time that he has to worry about that fellow taking people away from him. Paul?
The people were dignified on that too, whether the people start believing. That's the very thing that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And when you keep repeating, keep repeating, keep repeating, someone's going to pick up on it. It's going to spread.
Yeah.
And it's going to ruin reputation. It's going to ruin everything.
It does. It does. And I heard Homer Haley say, and he's certainly one that was around for a long time, and I've heard other men say the same thing, and that is, there's probably not a preacher on the planet that didn't want to throw up his hands and quit at some time or another because of nonsense like this. I have. Richard?
Ken, in politics, it's common knowledge that if you say something that has a certain amount of falsehood to it, and then they're challenged on it, when they make a retraction, 10% of the people that heard the first falsehood never hear the retraction. And a lot of elections have been swayed by the fact that the retraction was never heard by those who heard the first part.
Mm-hmm.
And that 10% is enough to elect politicians who can tell a lie and get away with it.
Yeah. Paul talks in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 about people that would rather believe a lie than believe the truth. Jim?
And a lot of times when people are saying that, you whisper it and it does a lot more damage than if you said it. People pay a lot more attention to
it. Oh, yeah.
Rather than, it's more effective sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, that little short sermonette was Nancy's fault. Because she's just talking about how vigilant we have to be and be on the alert against the way Satan operates. And again, like Paul said in chapter 2, we're not ignorant of his methods. We know exactly how he operates. But isn't it strange how we seem to fail to recognize it for what it is? Just like the gossip that Jim was talking about. Somebody starts whispering junk like that, and why don't our antenna perk up and say, wait a minute, that's Satan's tactic. Did you have your hand up?
Sometimes it's wrapped in a juicy hindrance.
Oh.
From the Swiss group.
Yeah.
If you want it, you want to hear it, you know, it's delicious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not really, but that's the effectiveness of it.
Well,
when you get to verse 14, that's,
yeah. I'll tell you another thing that makes it so appetizing, so palatable, is that if somebody has a burr under their saddle already, that just gives edge fuel to their fire. So you get somebody with their nose out of a joint about, you know, 1/1000th of a millimeter, and give them something they can latch onto, and they're going to run with it. You know, true, they don't care whether it's truth or not, because all of a sudden now they feel justified. And that's Satan. That's why Satan operates.
Rather than going to the individual and talking to them, that's the way it spread.
Oh, yeah. 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 When that guy, and our time's up, so, you know, when that guy was telling people up in Oregon that I was distributing pornography, and you know, I've been in that area for 15 years. You know, most people knew me and knew my reputation. One guy who was kind of new to the area, and he was repeating it, and one of my friends in that congregation who knew me very well said, "Have you talked to Ken about that?" "Well, no. Do you know if there's any truth to it?" "Well, that's what I heard." And to the fellow's credit, he called me, and I really appreciate this because this doesn't happen very often. The fellow called me, and so I told him, and I gave him I gave him enough information that he was fully satisfied, and then he apologized to me. He said, "Well, I was wrong." I said, "Well, you know, I just hope you," he was a young fellow, and I said, "Well, I hope you have learned a lesson. I really appreciate your calling." I said, "I hope you have learned a lesson that will stick with you through the years, and I'll bet it does. I'll bet he'll never do that again. He's off back in, I don't know, somewhere back east now. He moved out of the area. He's got transferred. But I would venture to say he'll never do that again. He learned a lesson, and that's good."
"But if that's what you told him, you have all his brothers
go to that and talk to him." "Well, yeah, that seems to be in the scripture somewhere, doesn't it, as I remember. How about Matthew 18? That'd be one place to start. Well, anyway, our time's gone. Come on in, and we will proceed from that point next week, Lord willing.